journey through the heart of America's economy, the dollar, inflation, and interest rates. Amidst this financial tapestry, precious metals are often considered guardians against uncertainty and inflation. Dana Samuelson, president of the American Gold Exchange, is here to address this landscape, which truly stretches as far as the eye can see and well beyond. I'm Joseph Cotto, your host, and this is NewsSight. Dana, thank you very much for being here tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Cotto. Joseph, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's going to be a great discussion, and you have a good deal of insight to share about quite a few things. The economy is always relevant, and we will get into that, I think, from a very unique perspective that you have. But before we begin addressing the heavy stuff, you have built quite a career in the precious metals sector. Why don't you briefly go over that so folks can know where you're coming from?
Well, I've been in the physical precious metals markets. This will be my 44th year. I got out of college in 1980 with a German degree, and I was completely unhirable, just like any college graduate was in 2009. I got a job working in a vault because I could be trusted, counting, shipping, and weighing, and I did that for 2 years. And then I got a lucky break. I was offered a job to be a coin appraiser, with Jim Blanchard, who is the man who is most responsible for the private re-legalization of gold ownership in the United States in 1974. Gold was illegal to own in the United States between 1933 and 1974. When Richard Nixon depegged the dollar to an ounce of gold in 1971, Jim understood fundamentally that that would cause the dollar to lose purchasing power over time, and he championed the re-legalization of gold ownership, sound money, and got it done in 1974. Well, the precious metals took off on the back of the inflationary 80s, inflationary 70s. There was some strife in the world with our hostages being taken in Iran for over a year. And the precious metals prices took off like a rocket from, $40 an ounce in 1970 to $800 an ounce in 1980. Silver went from about $2 an ounce to $50 an ounce. And by 1982, when I went to work for Jim, he had the biggest mail order coin company in the country, selling millions of dollars of precious metals and coins every year. And I ended up becoming his buyer, and I got to meet everybody in the industry and spent a lot of Jim's money with the industry, because we basically bought from the trade and sold to the public. And after 18 years in the business, I started my own company, American Gold Exchange, in 1998. That was 25 years ago now. And I was lucky because some of my colleagues back in the day who now run U.S. Mint distributorships for precious metals gave me more credit than I deserved when I started the company. But we've run a very sound business, a perfect business record for 25 years. We've never not paid for a purchase and never not delivered a sale. And I do what I love. I've painted myself right into a golden corner. I've also tried to give back to the industry. I'm past president of the Professional Numismatist Guild, which is the leading organization of rare coin dealers in the country. And I've also become an expert witness for the government, for the Commodities Futures Trading Commission and the Securities Exchange Commission, helping them to, Our business is unregulated. Anybody can become a precious metals dealer. And we do have some opportunists who have come into the marketplace, especially when times are good. And some of them are pretty aggressive in their pricing. Let's just leave it at that. So the cases are pending, but I'm trying to give back now that I'm getting a little long in the tooth in my career. So I've been lucky, been blessed, and I had a lot of fun because, you know, our business is affected by the economy, interest rates, inflation, geopolitical events. You know, there's never a dull moment because something always is making things interesting. And I get to handle a lot of old vintage coins as well. And there's a lot of history in any country's coinage, especially the United States.
To say the least, I've always found the precious metal sector to be really fascinating. And you've gone over why, in part why that is. It's your career has been really something else. And it's impressive. It is.
Well, thank you. It's just all happened organically. So looking back, it has amounted to something pretty significant, I am pleased to say. So thank you.
You're very welcome. And talking about the economy, I mean, that's, before getting to anything else with precious metals, obviously the economy in a general sense, it's a good idea to address that. A lot of people, almost everyone, is concerned about the value of the dollar and how inflation relates to that. And then it goes into the very dicey subject matter of interest rate hikes. And then obviously that relates to precious metals pricing. Trying to figure out where to start here is almost like a chicken or egg thing. But generally speaking, what are your thoughts on how the American economy is doing?
Well, the economy is doing better than most anticipated it would be at this point in the Fed rate hike cycle. The Fed raised rates more aggressively than they ever have, beginning in 2022 into 2023, from 0 to 5.25% to 5.5%. And we all expected the lag effect of that, because it takes a while for those rate hikes to ripple through into the economy and slow things down with the higher cost of financing. Most economists, myself included, I'm not really an economist, but have been confounded by the fact that the US economy remains resilient. If you look at GDP, we had a 4.9% GDP print in Q3 of 23, and then the last print was 3.3%, which are both are better than anticipated. Job creation over the last couple of months has been much better, robust, more robust than people anticipated, about 350,000 jobs 2 months in a row, where the previous year to 18 months had seen a steady, slow skid lower in job creation, down about 150,000 jobs, but that's popped in the last couple of months. So the consumer remains resilient. Our economy is 70% consumer spending, but credit card debt is hitting record highs at over $1 trillion, $1.13 trillion now, highest it's ever been. And the interest rates on credit card debt are over 20% now. So that's pretty expensive to have a big balance on your credit card right now. So I'm getting a little bit concerned that the consumer, which is the base of our economy, is getting tapped out. But employment remains good. And until the employment really starts to weaken materially, I think the economy will continue to move forward fairly well. But I do expect to see a slowdown. We just haven't seen it yet. So it's a bit confounding. Now, we're also running the biggest budget deficits we've ever run. We have a $2 trillion deficit last year, and that's, you know, materially higher by billions of dollars than we've had in the past. I don't know the exact figure, but that is a form of stimulus in itself. Plus, there's been a ton of stimulus money that the government threw into our economy in 2021 and 2022 to combat COVID that's still been sloshing around, which I think has been pretty much absorbed now. And I think that's confounded people thinking the economy would weaken sooner than it has, but some of that stimulus money has helped to support the economy. So there's a lot of variables that are unusual right now, making things a little bit harder to predict. But I do think we should go into a bit of a slowdown. Globally, China is not doing that well. Japan's in recession. Germany's in recession. The UK's in recession. The US economy is really the only economy globally that is holding up well right now. And it is a global economy. So I think at some point in time, that'll act as a drag on us, but we haven't gotten there yet. So I do think I'm quite pleased by how the economy has been performing, but I'm confounded that it's not weaker now than it might have been, but I do expect to see us weaken as time passes.
It's, I mean, the economy definitely is strange because most people say it's doing terribly for them. They say that they are in a worse position than they traditionally have been in this economy, even though the unemployment rate is very low. The inflation rate is not rising as it once did. I think the whole thing does boil down to what people expect their standard of living to be in relation to what they're actually getting. And from everything I've seen, and I research this as much as I can, people are principally concerned by the fact that they cannot afford to go about their lives in the manner to which they've become accustomed. So even if they have a job, even if the inflation rate's not going up as it once did, it went up so much, and a lot of people are so insecure in their employment, and a lot of them are working two jobs, in some cases even three jobs. And this creates a situation where the statistics look good, but people are feeling very terrible. And from what I gather, the worst thing, bar none, is that there's a lack of hope. A lot of people don't see their situation improving. They're sort of waiting for what you mentioned, basically, the economy to tank. It's going on across the world, or you know, if it hasn't tanked yet, the tanking is in process. So it's really, it's a time of great discontent with the economy, even though the statistics look great.
Right. Well, I would agree with you. And I think the culprit here is inflation. I mean, aggregate inflation, if you look at a website called Trueflation, aggregate inflation is up about 25% since 2020. And I've got kids at home. I go to the grocery store. What I used to be able to buy for $150, you know, on a weekly visit is now $300 on a weekly visit. And it really does bite. And we have a bifurcated economy where the lower class, the middle class, have been completely hamstrung by these higher prices. And where the upper middle class and the very wealthy, you know, are really not affected. So I understand completely how the statistics look good, but when people feel inside how this economy is working, they're not happy. And I get it because prices are a lot higher across the board for things. And we got very complacent for about 6 or 8 years when inflation was really low and we didn't see much price change. But what's happened over the last couple of years has been pretty dramatic. And when you get that pay cut, is what I call it, a pay cut, it really, that's what it really is. Prices don't drop. They just don't go up quite as fast. That's really, we have lower inflation, but that prices are still rising. They're just rising at a lower rate.
That is always the thing when it comes to figuring out the inflation. When it comes, I would say, to assessing the impact of inflation, people do like to say in government that it's getting better because the inflation rate is lower. And to some people, that would be misconstrued as saying that everything is becoming cheaper. But in reality, as you mentioned, it just means it's not getting as expensive as it has been, as quickly as it has been. But things are still, you know, getting more expensive. It's just building on top of the massive hikes that have already been made. So there is a lot of discontent with the economy and the deteriorating purchasing power of the dollar, unquestionably, in my mind, is at the root of that.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And you know, people have really been hamstrung. There's an economist I follow by the name of Lacey Hunt, who happens to live here in Austin, Texas, where I'm from. And he said, you know, the Fed pretty much got this exactly wrong. They overstimulated for COVID. They underreacted to inflation. And while trying to preserve 10 to 20 million jobs, they gave 180 million to 200 million people a pay cut, a real significant pay cut. And that's what's happened. And it's I feel for people because I see it. I feel it myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that everybody feels. I mean, unless they're at the point that money basically doesn't matter to them, and very, very few people are there. But what I would say is that the discontent over the economy is not going away anytime soon. And it's something that can obviously be used, and it is being used, to great political effect for those who are running against whoever's in power now. Although when it comes to the American economy, I would say that it's very often misunderstood by people across the board for a host of reasons, chief of them being that it's if you want to look at how the government relates to the economy, sure, Uncle Sam does a lot, particularly through the Federal Reserve. That's the biggest thing, although certainly not the only one. But there are also 50 state economies. And what one state does certainly has an immense degree of impact for its residents. Like the California economy now is in a really bad way. Same thing in New York, and it looks like the situation in California and the situation in New York that don't going to get worse. Meanwhile, someplace like South Dakota or Texas, where you are, or Tennessee or Florida, where I am, there is much more in the way of wage growth and job growth. Although, of course, wage growth, you have to factor in inflation, and that kind of takes it back to the national level. But the truth of the matter is, when people say the economy is doing great or poorly, it's not like America is a unitary state wherein, you know, everything is under a single jurisdiction. It really the impact that a state government has upon the economy cannot be understated. And in some places, places with very high populations like New York and California, things are not doing as well as they are in other places like, you know, South Dakota, which have a much, much smaller population. It's really, I wouldn't say it's confounding. It's just very complicated.
Right. Well, the economy is not a monolith either. There's so many different parts to it. So it's all the components combined, you know, are what really become impactful. You know, we're a bit insulated where I am because Texas has been a pro-business state. We don't have a state income tax. So that's beneficial. We have had a lot of people flocking into Texas. We're business friendly. So I don't feel it here, and I'm in Austin, Texas, which has been a booming city for 10 years now. So I don't feel the drag that some of these other states do. So I might not be able to comment on that as intelligently as others.
Yeah, Florida has a similar situation, although, you know, it depends upon where you are in the state. But some places definitely are feeling the hit in a way that basically is tantamount to a recession there. It's just not felt throughout the rest of the country. So a very complicated issue. But talking about the power of the dollar, I am not optimistic that it will build its value over the coming year. Some people might be, but I'm just not seeing it. I actually expect inflation to get worse as the year drags on, although exactly when can't be said. But certainly the Federal Reserve is trying to, by its words at least, keep things from getting really nasty. Although if it lowers rates, obviously that means there's going to be a rush of quote unquote easy money, and that will cause spiking inflation down the line. So the whole situation is really, I'll put it this way, it's definitely not a cause for optimism in my eyes.
Yeah, I think that we are in it for higher for longer with the Fed. And, you know, they talked about, surprisingly, at the end of their mid-December meeting that we might get 4 to 6 rate hike cuts this year, which nobody saw coming when they said that. So we all got to smoke a little hopium on the fact that we might get lower interest rates. And now they're walking that back because we've had some pretty good statistics over the last couple months, and the market's betting on 3 interest rate hike cuts this year. I think in the great scheme of things for 2024, what the Fed does will be actually less material overall than it has been for the last 3 or 4 years in their interest rate policy. A couple of quarter point cuts, 2 or 3 of them, I don't think are going to make that much of a difference overall to anything at this point in time. Mm-hmm.
We shall see, although I think there's a good chance you'll be right about that. Now, obviously, you are a precious metals guy. You have been for decades on end, generations on end, actually. So a lot of people do look to precious metals for stability as a hedge against inflation. The precious metals basically are the ultimate not get rich quick scheme, the anti get rich quick scheme. It's about wealth conservation. I think in this economy, you're probably seeing a lot of interest in precious metals because of the impact of inflation.
Yes, we've had a boom and bust markets in my market, and that's how we tend to be over time. We have feast and famine periods. So we do really well when the economy is not doing well, when interest rates are falling, actually, because higher interest rates create competition for gold and silver. If you can get a decent return on your money in a CD or a treasury bill, it makes the opportunity cost for holding gold seem higher. And gold is, it's an old stodgy metal, but it has no counterparty risk, which made it very desirable for a lot of people following the great financial crisis and very desirable for a lot of people following the economic closures once COVID reared its ugly head in March of 2020. So after each of these events, we've had huge buying waves have come into the marketplace. And we've also seen our debt explode on the back of these, both of these events. So one point I'd like to make to put things into perspective, you know, our debt today is about $34 trillion. From 1795 to 1995, the United States accumulated $5 trillion in debt. And in the last 28, 29 years, we've multiplied that sixfold to sevenfold. It's been a moonshot as far as our debt has gone. And if you look at the price of gold, it's gone up six to sevenfold during the same period of time our debt has. So if you measure gold in the U.S. governmental debt, it's been holding its purchasing power perfectly. If you measure the price of an ounce of gold relative to the dollar, it's a little bit more complicated. Gold tends to race higher on the back of trouble, and then it can fall pretty sharply when things normalize again. We saw that during the great financial crisis. Gold went from about $800 an ounce to $1,900 an ounce and stayed up at $1,750, $1,850 for a couple of years till things settled down. Then it dropped all the way back down to $1,150, $1,250 an ounce for 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. And then it started to go back up in 2019 when the Fed lowered rates a little bit. And then when COVID hit, it blew all the way to almost 2,100. So gold is trading near record highs right now and staying near record highs in dollars and also in every other currency around the world. On average, over the last 20 years, gold has increased about 7 or 8% in almost every currency. Now, it's lumpy. It doesn't do that every year consistently. It could go up 20% one year and down 10% the next. That's not unusual. But gold holds its purchasing power over time. And in inflationary times, I think it's a much better way to save money than to have money in dollars in the bank or in some other non-producing asset.
You know, there's two things, judging from what you were saying, that I really think you need to get into. But I really want to talk about the second one, but the first one I just have to address first. A lot of people say the national debt really doesn't concern me. It's been so high for so long. I've been hearing people voice their concerns about it for so long, and yet my lights are still on. I'm still able to get gasoline for my car. I'm still able to have conditioned air circulating through my house. So this whole national debt thing really can't be that big of a deal. A lot of people just sort of dismiss it at this point. What would you say to those people who believe that discussions of the national debt basically are irrelevant to their standard of living?
Well, at some point in time, the debt that we have and the rate at which it keeps increasing is going to take a bite out of everybody's standard of living, just like inflation has over the last 2 or 3 years. It'll cause the dollar to lose further purchasing power. And it's basically becoming a confidence game where as long as there's confidence in the US to perform and we don't have another economic challenger that's on our level, which we don't, you know, everyone thought China would give us a run for our money, but that's not gonna happen anytime soon. Our debt is still manageable as long as we can pay the interest on it. But the interest on our debt has gone from about $500 billion a year just a couple of years ago now to $1 trillion a year. And this is an economy that has, what, $22 trillion of GDP. The debt to GDP ratio keeps going higher and higher. And the amount of money that we are going to need to service our debt, especially if interest rates stay up, is going to continue to increase. Now, the only time basically in my entire life that we didn't grow our debt every year was in, I believe it was 1999. when we had actually had a balanced budget for 1 year. And that's when gold hit a record low of about $250 an ounce since 1975. So the debt problem is going to continue to grow and get bigger and bigger. You know, I don't think the government tends to fix anything until it breaks. And if the debt breaks our backs internationally in terms of confidence, that will be a huge problem for the United States. Now, there's something that goes along in tandem with that, which has reared up in the last couple of years, and that's this whole de-dollarization movement where countries around the world want to use less dollars. They don't want to be dependent upon the U.S. financial system, the SWIFT banking transfer system, because after Russia invaded Ukraine, we knocked them off of the SWIFT international bank transfer payment system. And a lot of other countries around the world said, hey, if we become politically unacceptable to the United States and they did it to Russia, they can do it to us. So now there's a pretty big movement not to rely on the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And we don't have a real challenger for the dollar yet, but we're going to get one. And the biggest thing that's happened over the last 2 years, which I don't think anybody's really aware of materially, is the fact that Saudi Arabia is now taking payment for oil in other currencies than dollars. And the petrodollar, which was invented by Henry Kissinger in 1973, where we said we would protect the Saudi oil fields militarily as long as they sold oil in dollars and then bought our treasuries with those dollars, that enabled us to finance our deficits for years. And it also made the dollar embedded in the world's financial system. Well, now there's a movement afoot to unentrench the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And it's happening slowly, but it's going to gain momentum at some point in time. And that has given U.S. citizens an incredibly huge financial benefit because commodities have been priced in dollars, oil, gold, a lot of our exports are all priced in dollars. We don't have currency fluctuations and commodity price fluctuations like other countries do. Most every other country in the world has a not only a commodity price fluctuation, but they have a currency price fluctuation against the dollar, which makes things doubly troublesome when things are not going their way. And we're insulated from that currency turbulation because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. And if our debt creates a reaction where foreigners no longer want to buy our treasuries, that is a real problem because that's helping to finance our debt, our $34 trillion of debt. So it all comes back kind of as a chicken coming home to roost. No matter how you slice it, our debt could hit us another way too. And that would be less dollars out in the world, more dollars coming into the U.S. We could have an inflationary period if more dollars are outside of the U.S. come in relative to other currencies. That's more dollars buying the same thing here is inflation, basically. So that's something people should be aware of is the BRICS movement to de-dollarize. And that will continue to accelerate over time.
It's that everything you bring up is spot on. It's definitely something to be concerned about if you want the dollar's purchasing power to be anything like what you become accustomed to. And very few people are aware of this. There have been alternatives to the whole transatlantic consensus, I'll put it that way, popping up for a while. The biggest one, obviously, is the Eurasian Union, the Eurasian Economic Area, which is obviously modeled on the EU. And it is, when that came about during the last decade, effectively, that's when obviously the West started getting very angry with Russia. I won't say it ignored Russia before that, but Russia just wasn't as big of a deal. But I do think that the rise of alternatives to basically the transatlantic consensus, that rise is something that's been going on for a while, no question. And it's my perspective that a lot of folks have been ignoring that. And then they finally took note of it and they flipped out over it and they continue to flip out over it. But this has been something which I think is basically inevitable.
Yeah, it's a slow momentum building process, and at some point in time, it's gonna pop up and go, "Hey, here we are, we're ready to do it." And that will be, it'll give the U.S. a bit of a comeuppance worldwide. You know, every major world power has lasted about 100 years if you go back in history, and we're past our expiration date on that. But we have the world's best economy, we have the world's biggest military. So we have those things going for us, and we've had the world's goodwill. We've been, you know, the benevolent kind of uncle for the world monetarily. But now we've been bullying. We've finally used the power of our world reserve currency status to bully a bit, and that's really what's hackled some of these other states. You know, China, India, Russia in particular, a lot of the Asian countries. So we'll just have to see how this goes. But at some point in time, the trend will become an event, and we're not there yet. But at some point in time, a switch will be flipped, and then people will go, "What happened? What really happened?" People watching it won't be surprised, but most of the country will be.
Absolutely, yes. Most of the country is enamored of sideshows, bread and circuses until things get real, so to speak. And then, of course, it's too late because you become a victim of events rather than someone who was able to prepare for them. Sad, but I mean, that's basically the course of history in too many different stories to begin summarizing. Now, the second question I was going to ask you is what would you say to younger people who are betting the farm on cryptocurrencies? And obviously, the crypto market has taken a thrashing, and it's profoundly volatile. And of course, it varies coin to coin, whatever. But a lot of people who are below age 35, especially in their 20s, would have laughed at someone who said that they were going to put money in precious metals. You know, these people, not people with money, precious metals, but the others who were pro crypto would have said, no, crypto is the future, and gold is something that does not have the same value as, say, Bitcoin, so on and so forth. Because I did see a lot of people who were very crypto friendly, to say the least, and they basically thought that Bitcoin was the new store of value in the way that gold was, except it tends to gain value quicker than gold. Therefore, gold is obsolete to Bitcoin. This was the argument. Obviously, it's not one I agree with, but it's certainly one that I heard. You know, a lot of people certainly have lost their shirts in the crypto world, but some people still swear by it. So, what's your perspective on, like I said, younger people who have said and to a certain degree continue to say that crypto is superior to gold?
Well, crypto actually has some of the same attributes that gold does. It allows you to have your money outside of the banking system, the traditional banking system, which some people find very agreeable. When it went from $20 all the way to 60, but almost $65,000 per Bitcoin steadily over a 10 or 12 year period, I mean, that's a hard moonshot ride to ignore. And I literally have been laughed at an investment conference by a 20-something who walked by my booth while we're exhibitors at, and he saw that we were gold dealers, and he looked over at me and he said, "When was the last time gold went up $1,200 in a day?" And I said, "Never." And he said, "My Bitcoin just did." And that's when Bitcoin was on its way up from about 50,000 to 60, over 60,000. Well, the big correction that Bitcoin went through was an eye-opener for a lot of people, because what happens when any market takes off and runs hot and continues to run hot is it sucks people in, and it sucks more people in near the top than the bottom. So younger people that are not experienced with market volatility, I think, got a real lesson. And we did get some of those people come our way when Bitcoin ultimately fell under $20,000 an ounce. The stability and safety of gold, I think, became a bit more attractive, especially silver. So we've got a lot of younger people that are what we call silver stackers these days that are just buying a little bit of silver regularly. But you know, gold allows you to take your money and get it outside of the banking system. It allows you to transfer wealth privately from one person to another without anybody knowing it. Gold and currencies, regular currencies, are hard to move across borders. But cryptocurrencies, make moving money across borders very easy. And that's one of the reasons the Chinese are cracking down on it, is because a lot of wealthy Chinese have moved their money out of the country via Bitcoin into the United States, into our property markets, and around the world and other places too. So there's a place for both. I didn't understand Bitcoin when it first came out. One of my friends told me I should get someone. It was $20 per Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and I laughed at him. And of course, you know, I've been laughing at myself ever since. But you learn. You learn, and there is a place for cryptocurrencies. What bothered me was that they were infinitely replaceable, or repeatable, rather. So there's, you know, I don't know how many different cryptocurrencies there are today. There's thousands of them. But I do know the governments around the world are getting into the digital currency business. They're not quite there yet, but that's coming. And they're not going to like the competition that the other currencies give them. So I do like cryptocurrencies. I like the idea of them. You know, basically, they're here to stay. I think there's a place for them. But I do think people need to understand they don't have enough of a track record yet where they all are still a bit of a speculation more than they are an investment or a real store of value. If you're going to trade in them, you really need to, you know, watch what you're doing and not fall in love with them.
Yeah, obviously, a lot of people did fall in love with crypto, and the results often speak for themselves, but some people have done very well indeed, and they continue to, but that's such a high, such an extremely volatile field to be in, and it's clearly designed for short-term speculation. And of course, there's the big question about whether cryptocurrency would continue to be regarded as a commodity and not a security. Obviously, the SEC, particularly under the Biden administration, was trying to get XRP labeled a security, but they were decisively routed by the federal court system. So, crypto is something that is in the realm of commodities, which is, I mean, that's what precious metals are, per Uncle Sam. So there is a similarity, at least there, between crypto and precious metals, but very different things, needless to mention, for the reasons you brought up.
Right. So I'm just kind of old fashioned because that's how I was raised, old school. I was not raised with a cell phone in my hand. I understand how a lot of younger people get that they can look on their phone and see what's going on, which was never the case, you know, when I was growing up. So it's just a different generation. And, you know, things do change, but some things stay the same and history tends to repeat itself. And the beauty of gold and silver are they are much more stable. They are man's oldest form of currency going back to ancient times. I mean, that gold and silver were currency and money. They're two different things, currency and money. Money is something that has a store of value, and currency is a medium of exchange. And they were that way for 2,000 years until the 1930s when the United States quit making gold currency and quit making silver currency in 1964. So gold and silver have gone out of the currency, but they remained money. They remained the world's oldest form of money. And one thing I'd like to point out is that central bankers around the world, and particularly in Asia, have been buying gold at a record clip over the last 3 or 4 years, the Chinese in particular, and the Russians. And this is part of their overall strategy to rely less on the US, the US dollar, to have a store of value that is has no counterparty risk. I mean, these are the banks that are printing all the extra money that's creating all the debt. And what are they doing with some of that money? They're buying gold with it. I mean, I think that speaks volumes, but that, again, that's under the radar for most people. But you know, central bankers were net buyers of gold in the 70s when the price was rising sharply. They were net sellers of gold from 1980 to 2010. And then after the great financial crisis, central bankers, the most conservative bankers in the world, the biggest bankers in the world, started buying gold again. And they've been doing so for the last 13 years, and they've been doing so at a record clip over the last 2 or 3 years. And I think that has a lot to do with the US debt explosion that we've seen with our debt going up over $6 trillion in just a couple of years. So they're worried about the US dollar. They're worried about our economy. They're worried about us. And that's how they're reacting to it, I think.
Oh, for sure. There's a lot of stuff to be worried about. Now, you do have some investing tips on what you consider to be the best ways to own precious metals, whether it's modern bullion or vintage, vintage precious metal is really something else. But, that would be the, I believe, pre-1933 American gold and European gold coins. You could obviously correct me on that if I'm wrong. You have quite a bit of insight here. Please feel free to share it. And since we're not discussing stocks, obviously I feel much more comfortable getting into this because the last thing anybody wants is to be accused of giving financial advice about securities, but that's clearly not what we're doing here. So please go ahead.
Right. Well, if you want to own precious metals, physical precious metals, I recommend that you buy sovereign minted, meaning government made, 1 ounce gold or silver coins that the U.S. Mint makes, the Royal Canadian Mint makes, the South African Mint makes, the Austrian Mint makes, the British Royal Mint makes, and the Australian Mint Royal Mint makes. So these are if they were ice creams, they'd be chocolate, vanilla, strawberry. The biggest, best countries in the world are making 1 ounce gold and silver coins. In the United States gold and silver eagles are the most popular, followed by Canadian maple leafs. And basically all they are round bars. And back in the 70s, a lot of these mints weren't in the business of doing this. If you wanted to own precious metals, you had to go to a refinery and buy a bar. A 1 ounce bar, a 10 ounce bar, 100 ounce bar. But what's happened is over the last 6 or 7 years, we've seen a problem with counterfeit merchandise coming into the United States from China. And they're knocking off precious metals items. Now, they're not going to fool a market pro like myself when you look and hold these items, but they could fool the novice. And what they're really best at counterfeiting are bars, because the designs on bars are plainer than the designs on these 1 ounce coins are, which are really just round bars. So I suggest if people are interested in physical precious metals, they shop around, to different dealers, look for dealers who are a member of the Professional Numismatist Guild, which I'm a member of and a past president of, because we tend to be the oldest, longest standing dealers. We're not opportunists. This is our livelihood. Stick with the mainstream, competitively traded, widely used items, which are U.S. gold and silver eagles, Canadian gold and silver maple leafs, and Austrian gold and silver philharmonics. They're just different pictures on the same ounce of gold or ounce of silver. Really a simple way to own precious metals. They have a higher manufacturing and distribution premium than you can get, say, buying an ETF, which is a more cost-effective way to trade the precious metals price change. If you think gold's going up and you want to trade it on paper, you can buy a gold or silver ETF, but that's not a good way to hold gold. If you want to own gold or silver, it's to have that hard-earned dollars of yours taken out of the banking system and put aside. Creates a private stash of yours that nobody else needs to know that you have. And it's a way for you to, I think, save money more effectively than you can in other ways. I have done a strategy myself where when interest rates were 3.5%, I took mortgages on my properties and I bought gold. And I did so in volume. And the reason I did it was because money was cheap and the gold price was relatively low. And I said, if I have a 10-year strategy, what could happen? Well, over the last 10 years, the price of gold has basically doubled. So if I own this gold and it doubles, I can sell some of that gold and pay the mortgage off with it and still have other gold for free. And it's so far, I'm about 3 or 4 years into this and it's working pretty well. So you need to have a longer view, have a bigger picture strategy. And there's definitely a place for it with precious metals. Now, the World Gold Council has done a study that says if you have about 7-8% of your net assets in precious metals, you have a good hedge against inflation and financial uncertainty. Now, we round that up to 10% just to make it easy for number's sake. But it allows you to have enough put aside so that you do have that hedge without losing opportunity and other market sectors. I also like real estate a lot. I like having the fact that I can own a property that has a tenant in it and they help me pay for that property. I mean, that's a great, great way to create wealth in the United States too. It's a little harder right now with interest rates so high, or higher than they have been, you know, relative to average interest rates over the last 30 years. Today's rates aren't that high, but relative to where they've been the last 10 years, you know, they seem exorbitant to most people. So that's how I think precious metals should be looked at. Those are the ways most people should look at purchasing them, deal with a respected dealer, and stick with the mainstream, competitively priced, widely traded products. So you have liquidity. It's easy for you to sell when you want to sell.
It is definitely easy to sell precious metals. It's probably, they are probably the easiest investment product to sell. In terms of, I'll put it this way, a person-to-person interaction, the lack of paperwork, so on and so forth. Definitely a very, very strong attribute of precious metals is there. Liquid nature, and that's nothing to be disregarded, even though a lot of people often do, because they look at making the money, they don't really look at the finer points of whatever investment product they're getting. So, you know, whatever, to each his or her own, but that's my perspective there. I think there is so much to be said for the precious metals market in America, because so many people are concerned about where the country is going economically. They're concerned about its stability. They're not just concerned about maybe some highly inflationary cycles. They're concerned about the long-term stability of America as an economic power, given the international events, which we've been discussing, and of course there are other issues to be concerned about. But precious metals absolutely are a way of conserving one's wealth. And that, for a lot of people, ironically, is what makes precious metal, this makes precious metals investing to them seem not worthwhile, because they're not so much looking at conserving wealth, they're looking at accruing wealth rapidly. And that's totally understandable. But precious metals are where people go when they want security and stability. Not all investors are looking for that. But I guess it's better put, not all investors are looking for that right now. But in the long run, I think everybody does wind up seeking that out.
Well, it's we don't really have a precious metals heritage in our country like they do in Asia or Europe, because we've never had our currency fail yet, and we've never had war on our soil. And if you've been in another country and your currency has failed, or you've had been ravaged by war literally on your doorstep, precious metals are a good thing to have in those situations. You understand why they're valuable. My brother got me into this business in 1980. He got his first job in this business in 1975. And one of the first things he did working for a precious metals company then was he went to Arkansas, where there was a Vietnamese relocation camp for Vietnamese citizens fleeing the Vietnam War at the end of the war, with gold literally sewn into their clothes. They make a bar that's thin, like a bookmark, that you could literally sew into your coat and carry ounces of gold out of the country that way. And that's how they cashed it in and got their start in the US. And that's not unusual if you go back 50, 100, or thousands of years. So we've taught a lot of people how to buy gold and silver during the great financial crisis. It took us a couple of years when, you know, the world almost came apart at the economic seams. You know, we were literally one federal meeting with bankers away from the banking system imploding in 2009. And they kept it together on confidence. During COVID, you know, all those people we took 3 years to train, you know, bought in 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, it was amazing how many people bought precious metals, but still the amount of people in the United States that really own precious metals, I'm estimated to be less than 5% of the public. We don't have a heritage of precious metals, and we don't teach finances like precious metals in this country. You know, one of my friends today is Robert Kiyosaki, who wrote Rich Dad Poor Dad, and Robert is a real precious metals advocate. He says, Dana, we're on the same team, and he's trying to teach financial literacy. That's what Rich Dad Poor Dad is all about, and he's a big precious metals proponent for the same reason that I am, is that it's a way for you to have some insulation from the banking system, the financial system. And, you know, if you take a step back, you know, the average guy on the street, we don't have the same advantages that hedge funds have to get lower interest rates or to get inside trades. And, you know, our country, we kind of teach people, hey, the American way is to get rich. Only now we've trained a lot of people to think that the American way is to get rich quick. But nobody ever really got rich quick traditionally. But that's what a lot of people want to do today. What can I do right now? What stock's going to make me more money today? And that's not a good mentality to have. One of my friends who is in the real estate business said, I give myself real estate and I give myself precious metals so I can have a gift to myself in 10 years. And I think if people take the longer view, they'll be much more suited financially, or well-suited financially, than they might if they're just trying to get, you know, make a quick buck today.
It's a shame that a lot of people don't really think about the long run when they get into any sort of investment. But, you know, it's not surprising. Human behavior is what it is. I will say one very distressing thing for me when it comes to seeing some people when they try to figure out what to invest in. They focus on basically politics, whether or not an investment is thought of as being green or sustainable, or whether it comports with what are described as ESG standards, now DEI as well. And it kind of, what this says to me is that people just aren't being serious about what they want to invest in, because they're so focused on an ideology that even though they want to make money, they really are acting on the basis of their politics and not their perceived financial best interest. And if people are of that mindset, it's kind of hard to make the argument to them about focusing on the long run, which obviously be the case when it comes to precious metals investing. And the lack of financial literacy, which you brought up, certainly is something here which cannot be ignored.
Right. I wish we had a better, you know, practical way to teach people financial literacy in our country, which we do not have at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know what the cure is for that. I have gone of the mindset, kind of like Warren Buffett, try and find good businesses that are going to be in it for the long haul. Follow the big trends. You know, if you look at the biggest trends and just kind of harness those and be patient and not get shaken out in the short term by, you know, what a knee-jerk market move or a knee-jerk political move, but just follow the basics, follow the biggest trends, follow demographics. You know, I think there's a place for investing based on what your heart tells you to do, but I think you should invest on where your mind tells you to do primarily. And, you know, people do like to vote with their pocketbook. And, you know, there's some altruism there when you're really putting your money where your mouth is politically, but it may not be the best thing for yourself financially.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And today a lot of people are very, I guess you could say emotional, ignorant would be too strong a word, but they're very emotional about any kind of financial decision making. I would say essentially because they are financially illiterate. It's about so many things, even people choosing to like get a degree which costs them several hundred thousand dollars, which they would need a student loan for that has a gargantuan interest rate, and then they can't get the sort of job they're looking for, and their financial future is very much in doubt as a result of that. You have so many people like that today. And it does boil down to a lack of financial literacy on their part. It's sad, but it's not shocking given, I guess, sociological trends would be the best way of putting that. So precious metals, they are such a force for stabilization that I think they have relevance regardless of what those sociological trends are, what economic trends are, certainly regardless of what politics are.
Right. Well, the politics and the business of the politics are going to influence the economy, interest rates, you know, whether we have, you know, pro-business government or not so pro-business. But in the bigger picture, you know, the United States is still the best place to be. We have the best markets. We have the best transparency. You know, I do think the game to a degree is rigged a bit. So you have to really look past the headlines, past what the big players are doing. I think if you just focus, get on a path that where you can really focus yourself and stay on it. And I do really strongly advocate real estate ownership for the basic reason that I like gold. Is like they're not making any more real estate, like they're not making a lot more gold every year. It's hard to get out of the ground. And as the demographics just of the world just keep getting bigger and bigger, more and more people, and that available pie relatively becomes smaller and smaller, it's going to make the asset value go up. And that's what we've seen. So I'm pretty conservative in my investing philosophy, and I tend to be old school. So I may leave some of the younger people, maybe a little bit bored, but I think there's a lot to be said about being steady and going for the long haul rather than the, you know, short-term get rich quick scheme.
For sure. And as we do, unfortunately, begin to wind things down, it's a shame because it's been such a great discussion. But you do have some views on where the precious metals industry is headed, as well as future opportunities for investors. So please share your perspective on these timely points.
Well, I do think that the gold price is going to continue to go higher. It's been tracking our debt pretty steadily for the last 20 years as our debt has gone higher. I mentioned that earlier. In particular, I really like silver today as an investment opportunity, because gold is trading just under a new all-time high at about $2,000 an ounce. It's been almost $2,100 in the last couple of months, where silver in 1980 and again in 2011 was $50 an ounce in 1980, and it was $49 an ounce in 2011. It's $23.50 an ounce today. It's under $25 an ounce. It's less than half of its two previous all-time highs. Now, silver tends to be a bit of a commodity metal as much as a monetary metal. So when the economically things are slower in the world, like they are today, it's not unusual for the silver price to be down a bit and to lag gold. But what has happened a couple times over the last 20 years is when gold makes a hot run, silver lags for a while. But then when it plays catch up, it can play catch up with a bullet. And I mean, go up 30, 40% in a matter of months. But you've got to be prepared for it and get ahead of it. And I think we're in a setup now just like that, where gold has been kind of hot and silver's lagging. And at some point in time, it won't be $25 an ounce. I think it'll be closer to $35 or $40 an ounce, which is a 30, 40% gain from today's prices, even if gold goes to $2,300 or $2,400 an ounce, which I think is inevitable based on the U.S. financial condition with our debt. Our politicians are never going to be responsible enough where we manage our debt properly. And, you know, we're going to have $40 trillion of debt in a couple of years. And our interest payment on that annually might be $2 trillion a year, which is 10% of our GDP just for interest service, let alone any pay down. So our finances are not going to get better. They're going to get worse. I think gold will help you, and I think silver will really help you, but you've got to be patient, and it might disappoint you a little bit along the way, but that's just going to give you more time to stack some. That's the way I look at it.
It is an exciting time, whether you perceive that positively or negatively. It is definitely an exciting time, and precious metals are an oasis of tranquility is too strong a word, but they definitely are an oasis of relative normality during times of great excitement. And I think they are worth bringing up for that reason, also because of the immense how the power they have relative to the broader economy. And that's something that often goes misunderstood or just unmentioned. But precious metals, I mean, they're so powerful that obviously FDR banned them, the ownership of gold, by executive order in the 1930s. And it was only in the 70s that this order was lifted. I believe it was during Gerald Ford's administration that Congress passed the law to make it so people could unambiguously own gold. gold, and people were getting prosecuted for, you know, keeping their gold after the Fed said you have to turn it in. And so that just goes to show how powerful of an investment gold is, even though it doesn't get a lot of airtime relative to trendier stuff, shall I say. The power is undeniable, and you only need to look at history to see why that is.
Right. You know, gold has never not performed in times of trouble. It's always been a source of stability for the people that own it. And we have a little inside joke in our industry. It's like, you know, what's the golden rule? Well, those who own the gold make the rules. And even J.P. Morgan said, you know, 100 years ago, you know, gold is money. Everything else is credit. And I've got to tell you, having accumulated some over my lifetime, it's kind of nice to be able to sleep a little bit more calmly when we have financial turbulence like we did during the great financial crisis and, you know, when the COVID economic disruptions came, let alone what a lot of other countries go through when there's, you know, war on their soil or their currency fails. So having a little bit of precious metals can go a long way for many, many people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think one great example before we go of an economy that was destroyed and basically people had to resort to bartering things and using precious metals, that goes without saying, Lebanon, that used to be the most functional economy in the Middle East. And now it's a basket case is basket case. And the people who had their investments in precious metals fared better than those who did not. And that's being very, very broad about the situation.
Right. Right. And, you know, I laugh a little bit about cryptocurrencies. Like, what do you do when the power goes out? Right. I mean, that's potentially a problem, but you don't have that with precious metals. So there's a place, you know, there's a place for precious metals. There's a place for crypto. There's a place for traditional assets. I like tangible assets. Tangible assets tend to do best in inflationary times. And I think the period that we're in for inflation will last a while longer. So I do really like tangible investments, things you can put your hands on in times like we're in now.
And obviously, if anybody has any interest in gold, nothing that we've discussed tonight has been personal financial advice, but they can certainly chat with Dana, who is, as I said, the president of the American Gold Exchange. Dana, where can people find you and your organization?
Well, we're a national physical precious metals mail order dealer out of Austin, Texas. Our company is American Gold Exchange. Our website is www.amergold.com, amergold.com. Best email address for us is info@amergold.com. Our website is rich in information. We have live, transparent pricing on the most widely traded, commonly traded, competitively priced items. You know, we don't have 2,000 SKUs on our website. We have about 200. We keep it simple for a reason. We're also vintage coin experts. So I'm an expert coin appraiser. We do a pretty big business in the old vintage U.S. gold coins. That's more of a supply and demand market than a precious metals market. It has a precious metals component, but it's a different market. So for most people, physical precious metals, modern bullion coins, are really, you know, the best place to be and a good way to get started. And we're happy to help anybody we can. We're consultative in nature, low pressure. We'll answer your questions. No order too big, no order too small. We'll help anybody that wants help in our sector.
That is great to hear. And Dana, thank you very much for stopping by tonight. It has been a great discussion. Covered a lot of ground in a fairly short time.
Thank you, Joseph. It's been wonderful speaking with you. I'm honored to be a guest on your program. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And setting it up, getting our schedules aligned was a bit tricky, but I'm really glad it finally worked out. And if you would like to appear on the program again, very glad to speak with you. There's no shortage of stuff to go over.
I'd love to. So thank you for that.
Outstanding. And everyone, thank you very much for having tuned in. Hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as Dana and I did. Please stay safe, be well, and cheers.